and that's a direct influence of the Muslim Brotherhood on society. Back in 2006, the cultural minister named Farouk Hosni openly complained about the movement back towards a veil. This is what he said. He said, quote, he said, there was an age when our mothers went to university and worked without the veil. It is in that spirit that we grew up. So why this regression? Why this regression? And the Muslim Brotherhood went nuts. Many people in the NDP, the ruling party, Mubarak's party, went nuts. They lambasted this guy for months and became the biggest scandal of the year in Egypt. I don't have it on my notes, but I ran across a person who had pictures of the graduating university of the main university in Cairo from the 50s, from the 70s, and the 90s. And you can see many women in those pictures. And you can see how in the first picture back in the 50s, there was hardly anybody wearing a burqa or anybody wearing any covering. The second picture goes up to the 60s, 70s, in the 70s, and you see about half the women, graduating class, wearing burqas. But, and after the 90s, and they're all wearing burqas. Okay, so it's this regression. The people are slowly going back to the fundamentalist ideas and the pure Islam, which we call radical Islam. And that's the work of the Muslim Brotherhood. Even though it's been outlawed as a political party, it still has its hands in the politics because it runs its independent people, and it's making itself, you know, lovable to the people, and it's having an influence on the culture. That guy that said that, the culture minister, was in big trouble for a long time. And Mr. Mubarak, he correctly saw that in other cultural signs of regression as a national security issue, because he knew that if the population became fundamentalist, foreign investors and money would flee the country. In an article back in 2007 in the IPS News, which is an Egyptian news agency, you can see this. This article says, quote, for the first time, President Hosni Mubarak has declared publicly that the banned but tolerated Muslim Brotherhood group represents a danger to Egypt's security. The president's statements came amid an ongoing government crackdown on the group, triggered by the appearance last month of what the official press has called an Islamist militia. In an interview published in the January 15th edition of popular independent weekly Al Asbar, Mubarak said that the Muslim Brotherhood constitutes a danger to the national security because it adopts a religious orientation. The president wanted to warn of the potentially injurious effects that the rise of the political Islam could have on the national economy, saying that foreign investors in Egypt would take their money and flee the country. He added that investments would stop, unemployment rates would increase, leading ultimately to Egypt's isolation from the rest of the world. Now he says, Mubarak's ruling National Democratic Party, the NDP, has for years pursued a relatively liberal economic strategy, opening Egypt up to foreign investment and pushing for privatization of state assets. The policy was accelerated after a major cabinet reshuffle in 2004 when a government of technocrats was appointed under the leadership of Prime Minister Ahmed Nassif. A government of technocrats. And what this guy's saying is explained by the testimony this guy originally quoted, Clarice, when he says that Mubarak's government has been pursuing relatively liberal economic strategy and they hired a government of technocrats. What he's saying is they are moving from economically now, they're moving from a socialist nanny state to a free market. This is how Mr. Feldman describes it. Same thing. He says, quote, the Egyptian regime has been based since 1952 on a coalition between the army and the bureaucrats. The army is in full control of both actual power and the economy. Ex-army officers are appointed to state-run enterprises and high-level administrative positions. More importantly, the army has an enormous economic arm that runs enterprises as diverse as construction companies and food distribution chains. In the late 90s, this picture began to change. Mubarak was trying to go to a free market system, okay? This is what it consists of. He says, it's no news for anyone following Egyptian politics that Gamal Mubarak, the president's son, was being groomed to follow his father. In reality, the elder Mubarak was never fully behind that scenario, whether it was a real assessment of his son's capabilities or the acceptance of the army to such a scenario, Mubarak was hesitant. He says his son Gamal step by step started rising inside the ruling party, and with him he brought two groups to the ruling coalition. First were Western-educated economic technocrats. And then he says, for the technocrats, it was the fiscal and economic policy that was their domain, and they performed miracles. The Egyptian economy under the Nassif government showed unprecedented growth. The currency was devalued, investment was pouring in, and the exports were growing. The real disaster in all this, however, he says, is that no one actually rationalized or defended those policies to the Egyptian public. The country was moving towards a full capitalist system, but no one explained why that was needed or why it was ultimately beneficial. He said, while restructuring is naturally painful for a population that was dependent on the government for all its needs, the people were fed the same socialist rhetoric nonetheless. It mattered very little that the country was improving economically. People did not see that. It's not that the effects were not trickling down. They were. It's that the people were used to the nanny state for so many years, they could not understand why the government suddenly was no longer providing them with all those services. And he goes on to tell how Mubarak's son, with these technocrats and Western people trying to turn the thing into a capitalistic system, started clashing with the army because Mubarak's son actually started vying with the army. The businesses that from the Western business people were competing with the army's businesses. There was starting to be a friction there. He says the army never liked Gamal or his friends because Gamal had never served in the military. His friends were threatening the dominance over the army. He said with the unfolding events, the army was finally able to put its narrative, its view, to the president and have his support behind it. The army's view is that Gamal and his friends ruined it. Their neoliberal policies alienated the people and angered them with talks of subsidies removal, while his party gang destroyed the political system by aiming to crush all opposition. What happened was, when Gamal was rising in power in his government, they started crushing all opposition. And also, the people got angry because they started taking away the subsidies. You know, the government wouldn't buy bread anymore. The government wouldn't buy this, and the government wouldn't buy that, because they're trying to move to a capitalist system, okay? This is really what pushed people over the edge this time. According to Mr. Feldman's testimony, the country was moving towards a full economic capitalist system, but nobody bothered to explain why such a system was needed or why it was ultimately beneficial to people. They just kept preaching their socialism. In his view, it's not the effects of the change weren't trickling down. They were. It's the people were used to the socialist nanny state for so many years, they couldn't understand suddenly why the government was no longer providing them with all those services. It seemed like the government was getting worse, but this particular incident actually wasn't. It's getting better. But in addition, Mubarak's son had used his power inside the government to crush all opposition. That means, you know, in the past, at least it was the opposition was able to participate in the government. Even though the representatives were so few in number, they couldn't actually challenge the ruling party. They were still had to be there and at least talk. And when Gamal rose to power, he shut that all off. He didn't allow any opposition in the government at all. So once again, it seemed like the government was getting worse. In this case, it was. Now, the Mubarak government was never a good government compared to what we, you know, say in the West as democracies. He was always a dictator, and he ruled the nation like all dictators do. So what Mr. Feldman is describing here is just the straw that broke the camel's back. The people had already been under this, you know, this iron thumb for 30 years or so. And then when they started to try and change into a free capitalist system, you know, it just didn't fly because they didn't do it right. They didn't tell the people, they didn't tell people what they're doing. And on top of that, the government got more rigid. So that's the straw that broke the camel's back. But before you start dethroning a generally pro-American dictator who has maintained a peace treaty with Israel for 30 years, you better know, or at least be reasonably sure, who is going to replace him, okay? Both Israel and America could end up in a much worse situation than we are now if the wrong people end up controlling Egypt. And for what I've learned about the Muslim Brotherhood and for its influence over Egypt, I believe Western leaders are fools, if not insane, Mubarak the way they have. You know, the West has unceremoniously hung him out to dry. Really, maybe the term standing on the back is better. I'd give you just two or three news clips from the 3rd of this month. February 3rd, 2011. News item says, Europe ups pressure on Mubarak, calling for immediate transition in Egypt. Well, you can read in my notes. Another one, February 3rd, says, U.S. officials, talks on Mubarak lead immediate. It says, talks are underway between the Obama administration and top Egyptian officials on the possible immediate resignation of President Hosni Mubarak and the formation of a military-based caretaker government that can prepare the country for free and fair elections. Free and fair elections, okay? I just want to read just one quote in this first article. Europe ups pressure on Mubarak, calling him to immediately resign. It says, it's not a question of gradually increasing pressure on him. He is the obstacle, says Jose Torreblanca, senior policy fellow of the European Council of Foreign Relations. European Council of Foreign Relations. And he says, only a quick and orderly transition to a broad-based government will make it possible to overcome the challenges Egypt now faces. This Council on Foreign Relations guy says only a transition to a broad-based government is going to make it possible to overcome the challenges Egypt's now facing. Okay, in the other article, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it says the president has said, that's our president, has said, now's the time to begin peaceful, orderly, and meaningful transition with a credible, inclusive negotiations. Okay, with credible, inclusive negotiations. These are important terms you got to catch when you're reading these articles. The term inclusive negotiations, the term broad-based government, means that Western leaders from Europe, from America, all of them, they want the Muslim Brotherhood to be included in any post-Mubarak government. Of course, that's democracy, right? Everybody has to be included. That also just happens to be what the Council on Foreign Relations is once. They're the globalists. They're part of the, these people run this show, okay? All these leaders are doing exactly what globalists are telling them to do. Dump Mubarak, demand that he immediately resign, set up a broad coalition government that includes everybody, including the Muslim Brotherhood. And not to be outdone by our globalist president or the idiots over there in Europe, on February 3rd, our illustrious Senate, in a rare showing of bipartisanship, rare, passed a resolution calling on Mubarak to step down immediately. The resolution originated with John Kerry, a nice communist, and John McCain, a two-faced Republican. It was passed unanimously by the Senate. And it calls on Mubarak to resign immediately. It also calls on the military over there in Egypt to act professionally and with restraint when dealing with the anti-Mubarak protesters. Kerry said the goal of the resolution was to begin transition to an interim government leading to free elections, free and fair elections. If they ever have free and fair elections in Egypt, it's going to be a disaster because the Muslim Brotherhood is going to walk away with the most power. A guy in Israel named Benjamin Ben-Eliezer, who is a former army general, a Labor Party chairman, and a cabinet minister, he was the first Israeli, public Israeli politician, to castigate Obama for his actions regarding Mubarak. You know, he says Americans still don't realize the catastrophe they have brought upon the Middle East. Americans still don't realize the catastrophe they brought on the Middle East. In an article called Ben-Elazar, Americans Don't Realize What They've Done, this writer called Hillel Fendel recounts some of Ben-Elazar's comments. This guy interviewed Ben-Elazar. Ben-Elazar said, when I watched the speech in which he said he would step down, said Ben-Elazar about Mubarak, it pained me to see his collapse. He stood by our side for 30 years. He was a strong leader. He kept proudly to Sadat's commitments and followed in his path. He always emphasized the strategic importance of peace with Israel and that this peace was the basis for stability in the Middle East. Asked by an IDF Army radio interviewer if he thinks Mubarak will step down within days, wait until the elections this coming autumn, then Eliezer said, I'm not a prophet. Look, the army is still behind him like an iron shield. The question is whether they will try to move out the masses with force. One thing is clear, that from our standpoint, that's Israel's standpoint, is a tremendous loss. He says, we learn from history. We remember what was said when Carter proposed that the Shah of Iran give up nicely and allow Khomeini to take his place. In Gaza, too, when the Americans came in, they supervised the democratic elections in which Hamas came to power, if you remember. He said, if there are elections in Egypt the way the Americans want, I would be surprised if the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't win. This will be a new Middle East, radical Islamic extremist. He says, I think the Americans still don't realize the extent of the catastrophe into which they have pushed the Middle East. It's still too early to judge, but this is not their first mistake. This is not their first mistake, he says. Unfortunately, they're also the godfathers of the construction freeze in the territories, something that no American administration ever did before. Now, this guy's not exactly a right wing. He's kind of left. He's not a left winger, but he's more left than right. He believes that, you know, to stop the fallout of all this stuff, they should make a deal right now with the Palestinians. So he's not a right wing fanatic saying this. And his pessimism about what's going on over in Egypt, how it's going to turn out, is shared by many Israelis who hold Mubarak in high esteem. You see, because after all, Mubarak is the primary reason Israel was able to cut its military budget and spend it on its culture and grow its economy. It's the reason they can have their troop presence reduced along the Egyptian border, even though Egyptian's military has now become one of the strongest in the Arab world. See, even though Mubarak is a dictator who rules with an iron fist and his administration is certainly corrupt. He's no Saddam Hussein or Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the guy in Iran. He hasn't declared jihad on America or Israel, and to the contrary, over the last 30 years, Egypt has been America's most important and strategic ally next to Israel. Yet the moment his regime started to crumble, all the leaders of the West, all of them, they wasted no time in hanging him out to dry. Now, this isn't new, really. In fact, for many years now, the United States has been actively working to undermine Mubarak's authoritarian regime. And it didn't start just with Obama, though he's taken to a whole new level. It started in 2005 when President George W. Bush, the conservative, supposedly, the Christian conservative, said that America would no longer, quote, tolerate oppression for the sake of stability. America would no longer tolerate oppression for the sake of stability. And later that same year, in Cairo, Secretary, the then Secretary, Condoleezza Rice, she explained how Bush's freedom agenda, trying to import democracy to the Middle East, applied to Egypt. She said, quote, the Egyptian government must fulfill the promise it has made to its people and to the entire world by giving the freedom to choose. So under the heavy pressure from the United States, Mubarak loosened the restraints and restrictions on the parliamentary elections in that country. And the result was the Muslim Brotherhood captured 20% of the seats in that first vote. 20%. Does that sound familiar? How about the democratic elections forced on the residents of the Gaza Strip back in January 2006 by America? They were given a chance between voting for the supposedly moderate Palestinian Authority, or Fatah, and Hamas, which is the most radical terrorist group in the world at that point. The people of Gaza gladly voted for Hamas. And the idiots in the White House just couldn't understand why the people of Gaza would do such a thing, why they would vote that way. Well, one reason was they voted that way is because they hated the PA. And one of the main reasons they hated the PA was because of its rampant corruption. The leaders of the PA spent the money all the nations were giving them, millions and millions and millions and billions of dollars. They spent them on themselves first, and then on weapons for terrorist activity. If there's any money left over, then they use it to feed the people in Gaza. Hamas, on the other hand, did exactly what the Muslim Brotherhood has been doing in Egypt for the last 20 years. They established all kinds of social services, hospitals, schools, and they spent millions of dollars feeding the people, making their living standard better. And when it came time to vote, Hamas, it was swept in. Also, Hamas is adamant about making no compromise or peace with the Jews. Hamas's attitude is, and has always been, it's all or nothing. Surprise, surprise, that's exactly the attitude of the majority of Palestinians. See, so only a blind and deaf moron couldn't see beforehand what the outcome of that vote would be. Now, after the people in the Bush administration pushed Mubarak to open up his voting thing, make it more freer, and they saw what happened, they backed off. They stopped complaining about his authoritarianism and his human rights violations. And then Mubarak, in turn, turned around and clamped down on the Muslim Brotherhood again. But America and Europe didn't learn a lesson. They turned around and did the same thing in Gaza and saw even more disastrous results. See, the problem isn't with the corrupt leaders of these Arab regimes. The problem is with the everyday Arab on the street. Most of them. Not everyone, but most of them. The vast majority of them. It's the everyday Arab who hates the West. It's the everyday Arab who hates Israel and wants every Jew butchered. It's the everyday Arab who loves Islam. And the more Islam he's under, the more he likes it. So whenever you give the everyday Arab a chance to vote in a free and fair, quote, election, they always choose the most radical Islamic party available. They don't want to be secular Arabs. They want to be religious Arabs. Now, President Obama's anti-American, pro-Islamic agenda has only empowered and emboldened the Muslim Brotherhood and those who support it. For example, in early 2009, while Mr. Mubarak was warning U.S. diplomats about the Iranian cancer that was spreading throughout the Middle East, President Obama was hosting a meeting with the Muslim Brotherhood in the White House. In June of 2009, when Obama went over there and delivered his, you know, anti-American bootlicking speech to the Islamic world, the Cairo audience was packed with members of the Muslim Brotherhood was outlawed. And the only reason they're there is because he forced Mubarak to let them attend that meeting. And in that speech, he said, Iran had every right to develop nuclear power. I'm sure that was very comforting to the few pro-Western nations that are in that area. And by the way, Mr. Mubarak didn't even attend that address. That tells you a lot. So in a few days after that Cairo speech, tens of thousands of young, angry Iranians poured into the streets of Tehran demanding democratic reforms from a regime that is rapidly, rapidly anti-American. The very same kind of freedoms the demonstrators in Cairo are now calling for. But Obama was silent. And he excused his silence by saying, you know, it's not productive given the history of the U.S.-Iranian relations to be seen as meddling. Yet when it comes to a pro-American Arab government, Egypt, when they start clamoring, he immediately starts to meddle in Egypt's affairs. He publicly sides with anti-Mubarak protesters. He then applies huge pressure on Mubarak to immediately step down. And the fact that Mubarak said he was going to not seek re-election, he's going to try and move towards free elections, and that wasn't good enough. Obama wants an immediate transition. He wants him to step down now. He wants the power to be shifted. And guess where it's going to go? It's going to go to the Muslim Brotherhood. In the 3 decades that Mubarak has ruled over Egypt, which is a nation, by the way, in which most of the people have a very unfavorable attitude towards America and would welcome a greater Islamic influence over their government, he has managed to suppress religious extremism and his radical Islam domestically while advancing the interests of the United States abroad. And during that same time, he's maintained peace with Israel. And the thanks he gets from our government for all that is we toss him under the bus in favor of a popular uprising that's going to ultimately be hijacked by somebody, probably radical Islam. Those guys over there, those young people, they can't form their own government. They don't know what they're doing. They're just out in the streets clamoring for freedom. Somebody's going to take control of that government. It's either going to be a military, or if the military hands it over to the civil authorities, the Muslim Brotherhood is going to take it over. So don't believe all the propaganda you're hearing right now about how the Muslim Brotherhood is not a violent organization or it's an organization we can live with, peace with, and work with. That's lies. That's what's coming from the White House and the left wing, because they're trying to hide the truth, all right? The aim of the Muslim Brotherhood is and always has been the establishment of a worldwide caliphate. It's the only religion and the only form of government there is. And they're going to use any means at their disposal to bring it about. Now, back in 2007, an Egyptian-born American scholar named Dr. Mahoun Fandi wrote an article warning about the possibility of the Muslim Brotherhood taking over both Egypt and Syria. And the article was referred to in a Middle East Media Research Institute. They referred to his article and their article called What Will Happen If the Muslim Brotherhood Takes Control of Palestine. They give quotes in this article. According to him, the rise to power of Hamas, which was a direct result of American pressure to have democratic, free, and open elections, all right, the rise of Hamas in Gaza, it's going to strengthen the Brotherhood in different places like Egypt and Syria. And in his article, he says that until Hamas came to power in Gaza Strip, Palestine was a symbol of general Arab nationalism. After the rise of Hamas, the terms of the discussion changed from pan-Arab nationalist terms to religious terms. The struggle, as he saw at the time of writing, which is 2007, was a struggle of who was going to possess Palestine as a symbol. The Muslim Brotherhood, represented by Hamas, or the nationalist camp, represented by the PA, or Fatah. And I don't necessarily agree with that thesis there, but in that article, he certainly explains the power the Muslim Brotherhood has in Egypt. And he asked what the effect would be if the Muslim Brotherhood, that is Hamas, captured Palestine. Hamas is just a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. What happens if Hamas captures Palestine as a religious symbol, not a nationalistic symbol? He said, first of all, it's going to transform the Palestinian problem from a resolvable territorial struggle into a religious struggle that will never be resolved, can't be resolved. And this is what he says next. He says, quote, the success of the Muslim Brotherhood in Palestine means turmoil in Egypt. Today, that was back in January 2007, today this country is witnessing a fierce battle. He's talking about Egypt. Today this country is witnessing a fierce battle pitched between the ruling party, that's Mubarak's party, and the banned Muslim Brotherhood party, and it appears that the battle is going to the Muslim Brotherhood. In light of the storm of responses to the Egyptian culture minister Hosni's statements about the hijab, remember we read that as a sign of regression? He said, in light of those statements and the furor that came up over that, it became clear that the number of Muslim Brotherhood supporters inside Mubarak's National Democratic Party might be greater than the numbers in the banned Muslim party itself. So he's saying that the Mubarak government is riddled with Muslim Brotherhood people because there's just as many as them freaking out over what that guy said about the veil, going back to the veil's regression, as the people in the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood has infiltrated into all Egypt's state apparatuses. He says the Egyptian press is perhaps the best reflection of this infiltration. The front and back pages of the Egypt's government papers belong to the ruling party, while the 20 inside pages of every paper belongs to the Muslim Brotherhood, and they do what they want with them via their correspondents, theoreticians, and propagandists. He said whoever reads the Egyptian press today cannot but notice that Egypt is living in the Muslim Brotherhood era. Over more than 30 years, the Muslim Brotherhood has gained control over Egypt's domestic arena, its streets, its institutions, and its press. It's between it and full control, except for foreign issues, the first one of which is a Palestinian problem. That's an Egyptian's view of the power the Muslim Brotherhood has in 2007. Okay, now a lot has happened since 2007 till now, but still, that's a grim assessment, okay? If you ask me, it's pretty grim. Now, on January 28th of this year, a guy named Chuck DeVore wrote a very insightful article. It was called First Protest, Then What? Will the Muslim Brotherhood soon be running Egypt? In that article, he reiterates how just a few weeks earlier, on January 11th, he had warned in the pages he writes for the Investor's Business Daily, that Egypt was on the brink of what could be a chaotic transition in power, and those who would eventually be leading the nation needed closer scrutiny. This is what he said in this article. Just quoting part of it. And again, all these articles, I have links to you, and go read them yourself. He says, for the first couple of days of unrest in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt's largest, best organized, and most potentially ruthless opposition group, sat on the sidelines. As expected, after Friday prayers at mosques around the country, the Ikhwan, which is the Arab name for the Muslim Brotherhood, swung into action, swelling the protests and escalating the violence. Now, the key question for the Arab world's most important nation is, who will lead Egypt? In spite of popular mass protests and the pleasant familiar face of former UN nuclear inspector Mohamed El-Baradei, now under house arrest, there are only three groups with the power to end up leading Egypt. Only three groups. The Mubarak family, the military, and the Islamists. That's the Muslim Brotherhood. He says President Mubarak, who is 82, has been in power since 1981 when a hail of Islamic gunfire killed Anwar Sadat. And he's been grooming his son, Gamal Mubarak, 48, banker by profession, to run for president in an election scheduled for late this year. That plan has died in the chaos of Cairo streets. Then he's talking about the army. He says Lieutenant General Omar Suleiman, 74, Egypt's spy chief since 1993, is leading the military, rival to Gamal. He says that the military's discipline appears spotty in this crisis, bodes ill for both General Suleiman and Mubarak. That leaves the Muslim Brotherhood, a well-organized but outlawed group with mass support among Egypt's poor and religiously inclined people. The Ikhwan is in a roughly analogous position to the communists in Russia in 1917, whose iron will and willingness to use violence required only 7 months to seize power from the fragile transition government that overthrew the Tsar. That's pretty interesting. Anyone who thinks an open and free vote in Egypt would not result in the Muslim Brotherhood winning the majority of votes is living in a fantasy world. Now, there's been a cultural struggle in Egypt for many years between the religious and secular people. And he says the Brotherhood's winning, this other guy. Okay? And you can see signs of that victory all over Egypt. Some of the upper class are secular. Some of the upper class are religious. Most, the vast majority of the lower class, are all religious. See, most of the population of Egypt is lower class, not upper class. So the biggest part of the biggest concentration of population is religious. And they would welcome a government run by the Muslim Brotherhood, I believe. There's a sizable portion of Egypt that's younger. They're young and educated, mostly secular. And they're the ones just being interviewed and stuff because people are trying to put them in front. But from what I can see, these young people, they're viewing that cultural struggle that's going on in Egypt through rose-colored glasses. They're too quick to dismiss the Brotherhood as a small minority of loudmouths who have very little influence over the people. That's more wishful thinking than a realistic assessment. If you ever read that, you read people that say that kind of stuff, they're not telling the truth, I don't believe. In a February 3rd article by Ken Timmerman of Newsmax, he quotes former federal prosecutor Andrew C. McCarthy, his view of what would happen if the Muslim Brotherhood came to power in Egypt. This is what he said. He says, the Brotherhood would neither keep the peace nor support our efforts against terrorism. Its doctrine is a doctrine. If you fall for its claim to be against terrorism, you're falling for a word game. They do not consider attacks against Israel or against Western forces in Muslim countries to be terrorism. They consider that to be resistance.